to be here and talk to everybody today. So I'll try to give a general overview of some work I'm doing in, related to the search for Wnt dark matter. So there's going to be a couple of particular experiments I focus on, so my talk will be roughly divided into two parts here. First part is going to talk about some interesting limits and detection prospects of Wnt dark matter particles with the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which was launched a couple years ago and is shown here on your left. And the second part of my talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about some interpretation of results from direct dark matter detection experiments, such as the cryogenic dark matter search here shown on your right. So now, if you read the blogosphere the past few weeks, you might have seen that this, you know, where this is being touted. The upcoming decade is touted as the decade of dark matter. And I think because of these two experiments in combination with the possibility to create dark matter particles at the Large Hadron Collider, I hope to convince you that this is actually true, and this actually does potentially hold the promise of being a decade of some very interesting science that can break through in this field. So before I start, let me just give a general overview and motivation for the need for dark matter in the universe and why dark matter is different than the normal luminous matter that we're all used to. So this will be a review to many people in this room here, but let's just kind of start here to touch base. So if you look at the distribution of galaxies in the universe on the largest scales, you can see a picture, as is shown here on this famous image of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, where the observer here is roughly in the center, and farther away is towards the end of these slices here. And what you notice here in this false color image is that the distribution of galaxies in the universe is not uniform. Okay, it's lined up along voids, or lines up along walls and filaments, and in between these walls and filaments of galaxies, you see large voids, you know, orders tens of megaparsecs or so, and across in several instances. And if you want to zoom in on some in a smaller region of this galaxy distribution, what you might see here is a distribution of galaxies in a cluster of galaxies. Okay. So the luminous matter here, each one of these bright objects is roughly a cluster of galaxies. And if you do dynamical measurements of these clusters of galaxies, such as you measure their velocity dispersion, you do gravitational lensing type measurements, what you typically find is that there's more matter in this cluster of galaxies than you can count up that you see in visible light. So this result was, of course, known back almost a century ago, going back to the first results of Fritz Zwicky when he studied the Coma cluster of galaxies. And it progressed the need for this dark matter, more matter than we see in luminous material, has sort of progressed over the past century, going up through measurements of rotation curves by Vera Rubin and Ken Friedman and collaborators. Okay, so when you put this sort of picture together, what you find is that the observed galaxies that we see in the universe sort of trace an underlying dark matter component, okay, that exists, that we actually only really have access to on these scales through gravitational effects. Okay. So when you put this picture together more generally and you look at this distribution of galaxies and you combine with measurements of the cosmic microwave background, distances to type 1a supernova at high redshift, what you come up with is sort of a standard cosmological model, okay, in which sort of the matter distribution in the universe was seeded by scale invariance and adiabatic spectrum of initial density perturbations. Okay, so the galaxies that we see reside in these peaks of the dark matter distribution, largely we call dark matter halos. Okay, and the universe is dominated by dark matter, or by dark energy and cold dark matter. Okay, and if you take an inventory and slice of what's the cosmic energy budget of the universe, you find that most of the energy density is in dark energy. Second most is populated by this dark matter substance, and the stuff that we know, baryons, photons, neutrinos, etc., protons, neutrons, that makes up a much smaller fraction of the energy budget of the universe, roughly 5% or so. Okay, so in my talk today, I'm going to be focused mainly on this dark matter component, and really the question I want to address here and the takeaway point is, what is this and why are we making progress and how are we making progress on understanding what this component is? Okay, so I've motivated the need for dark matter, I hope, in these past couple slides, through gravitational type effects. What I haven't actually told you yet is why it actually behaves different than normal matter and how it actually behaves different than normal matter. Okay, so one can actually see that it does actually behave differently by looking at this famous and spectacular image of the so-called bullet cluster, which is a colliding cluster of galaxies here. And in the false colors image here, you see the gas distribution of these colliding cluster of galaxies. And overlaid on this gas distribution, you see a contour map of where most of the matter is in this cluster of galaxies. So now what you notice here is that the gas, the types of material that we that we're used to. When these galaxy clusters collide, they undergo electromagnetic and ram pressure forces. And so in this collision, the gas actually lags behind where most of the matter distribution sits. So here's where the peaks of the matter distribution are, these clusters. Okay. So what this really tells you here, in combination with the figure on the left, where you see sort of the test particle galaxies tracing the overall matter distribution, tells you there's really two distinct components to these astrophysical systems, these clusters of galaxies, right? One that's weakly interacting, doesn't interact via sort of standard electromagnetic type forces, right? And then there's the baryonic material that we know and love. Okay, so this picture basically just motivates how clusters and galaxies are formed of sort of two different, you know, if you will, types of matter constituents, very broadly. Okay, so in this talk, I'm actually not going to be as much interested in, you know, dark matter in galaxies far away as I'm going to be interested in dark matter in our own Milky Way galaxy. Okay, because we're going to try to detect the dark matter particles that exist in our own Milky Way galaxy. So what's the evidence that there is actually dark matter in our own galaxy? Well, one can look at measurements of the galactic rotation curve, as was done in these recent results from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which measured the galactic rotation curve from the distribution of stars out in the galactic halo to distances of about 60 or so kiloparsecs. So to kind of normalize you, we at the Sun, we're sitting here at about 8 kiloparsecs. And what, of course, you see is a common feature in all astrophysical systems. You see roughly flat circular velocity curve as a function of radius, right? And sort of there's three major components. If you break this up into the components of what galaxies are made of, you see sort of a central luminous distribution, which we call the bulge material. Okay, so these are stars in the central region of the galaxy. You see a more luminous disk component, which contributes a gravitational potential that looks something like this dashed dotted curve. And then to sort of fill in the gap, what we need is a non-luminous dark matter halo that rises out to large radius. Okay, so if you just add up these two luminous components together, you'd fail miserably to actually account for what this data looks like. Okay. So another point to notice here is that the solar circle, it's roughly believed that, you know, we have basically equal contributions from stars and dark matter to the local gravitational potential. Okay, so there's a substantial amount of this dark substance in our solar neighborhood, like sitting in our coffee cup, that we want to try to detect. Okay, so that's the evidence for that there is dark matter in the universe and in our Milky Way. So the question now is, what is it? Okay, so that's really going to be the theme of what I talk about today. So if you're in astrophysics, right, well, the first thing you think of, in fact, this is a question I got yesterday when you're talking about what is dark matter. Well, you know, there's lots of junk in the universe, right? There's lots of old stars, faint stars, maybe planets floating around. So the question is, you know, could dark matter just be in the form of, you know, normal astrophysical type objects that we just don't see, our telescopes are not sensitive to yet? Well, it turned out that this conclusion was tested in the past couple decades via so-called gravitational microlensing experiments. And by monitoring the distribution of stars, say, in a nearby galaxy, right, if our galactic halo is comprised of these compact objects such as dead stars, such as faint stars or planets, what you find is an anomalous brightening, okay, of stars in nearby galaxies. So this effect is so-called microlensing, which is predicted by Einstein as going back to the 1930s. This experiment actually was executed in the past couple decades. And the results of this experiment generally show, if you plot, you know, what's the mass of this type of compact planet-type object versus how much of the halo it can actually, how much of the mass density of the halo it can actually be in the form of this object, what you find is that roughly across the mass scales of astrophysical interest, say a solar mass, which is right here, planetary mass scales, which are right here, somewhat larger mass scales over here, what you find is that in this sort of regime, there you can't have more than about 10 to 20% of the fraction of the Milky Way dark matter halo that exists in the form of these planetary or star-type compact objects. Okay, so to sort of normalize you, so here's the measurements, and anything above these curves are ruled out as unlikely to form the majority of our dark matter halo. Okay, so if you want to try to make up the dark matter in terms of solar mass objects, you can't probably get more than 20% of that halo, of the dark matter in terms of that. So yeah, so there are gaps in these measurements, right? That's definitely true, right? So right, if you can, you know, concoct a substance of, you know, primordial black holes of that mass, then right, then you might win. Okay, so this is roughly the picture, and this is why sort of, so these are so-called MACHOs, massive astrophysical compact objects, right? And this is sort of why this is a dark matter candidate has become out of favor in the past couple decades. So the question then is, what is the dark matter? Okay, so
you know, the first step you can take after you have this macho result is you go through the inventory of particles that you know in the universe, okay, you know, neutrinos, etc. And once you start going down that checklist, what you'll have found is that really there's nothing in the cosmic inventory that's sort of well motivated to be a dark matter candidate. Okay, so we don't get the right pattern of structure formation if we invoke the neutrinos that we know to be the dark matter. Plus, their abundance in the universe is actually not large enough. Okay. So next thing you would do is, okay, go down to the next step and say what particles may exist in the universe, what particles may exist according to the theories. Well, there's kind of a neat little trick here. Sort of extensions of the standard model would predict that there's sort of copious amounts of particles at about the 100 GeV range, okay, that are at this weakly interacting scale. Okay, and these are the types of particles that the LHC would hope to detect. Okay, if you consider sort of weakly interactive mass of particles from a cosmological perspective, and you go and you calculate the abundance of these particles in the universe, which is sort of a standard job of any cosmologist, what you find is sort of a neat little result, which is often called a Wimp miracle, which states that if you follow the evolution of these particles back to early times in the universe, so if you want to look at the top axis here, this is the time, say, since the beginning of the universe. Initially, these particles will track their equilibrium number density, okay, when they're interacting very strongly with the rest of standard model particles and the rest of the cosmic soup. Okay, eventually, the Hubble expansion rate becomes much larger than the interaction rate, and these particles so-called freeze out and make a relic abundance that we can potentially measure in the universe today. So if these particles would have tracked their equilibrium value and they would have stayed in equilibrium long enough, then the abundance of these objects would be negligibly small. Okay, so this is a Wimp miracle, as has been coined, and sort of, you know, whether or not you believe that this is in fact a miracle, this does actually motivate us in astrophysics and cosmology to go out and search for signatures of these particles. Okay, so it gives us a well-motivated model to look at. Okay, perhaps even maybe you could argue even much more theoretically well-motivated than sort of macho-type objects. So a large part of my talk. The motivation for my talk today is going to be searching for these particles in modern detectors. Okay, so how do we search for these things? Well, I said before that these WIMPs, they interact with the rest of the particles in the cosmic soup, right? Quarks, neutrinos, neutrons, etc. So what happens to these WIMPs? These WIMPs couldn't, right, they not only scatter via these particles, they could also annihilate into these particles, okay? So what happens when these WIMP particles annihilate? So here I just took an example of, you know, 100 GeV scale WIMPs annihilating. Okay, so what kind of signatures would they make? Well, if you ask, okay, what can they annihilate to? What's kinematically allowed? They can annihilate to quarks, different flavors of quarks, gauge bosons, different types of leptons. Okay, so what's the spectrum here of outgoing photons that you get? Okay, so where do you get the photons from? The WIMPs will annihilate the quarks will then hadronize, turn into pions, the pions will then decay. Okay. And generally, what you find here is that for scales of about 100 GeV WIMPs, which is the mass scale here, right, the spectrum of photons that you might get from such an annihilation, you know, tends to peak in the energy range of 100 MeV to about a GeV or so. Okay, so there's minor variations in the exact shape of the spectrum depending upon the exact channel. For example, if you look at annihilations into tau leptons, you get a bit of a harder spectrum, more photons at high energy relative to the standard type quark flavors. Okay. So this is the spectrum now we're going for when we want to search for signatures of these particles in the universe. Okay. So this is a standard scenario. And I should also mention you can have more exotic type scenarios of what you annihilate into. You can annihilate sort of directly into gamma ray lines, okay? In which case you not make an actual spectrum, but you make a spike, you know, sort of near the mass of where the particle is. Okay, so but in standard sort of scenarios, the physics says that those processes are suppressed relative to the spectra shown here. Okay, so we told you what the WIMPs can annihilate to, so the question is now where do we look for this in the universe? Okay, so I went to the trouble of telling you how much dark matter is in our Milky Way halo. So the reason is because this is going to be a good laboratory to study these processes. Okay, so the question is where exactly do we study these processes? Well, if you're sort of a theorist and you don't care about, you take the unreasonable approach that there's no other astrophysical processes in the universe that produce gamma rays of this energy, this is roughly what you get in terms of your picture of what the Milky Way would look like. Okay, this is a numerical simulation done by the Aquarius collaboration. So, of course, so this is in galactic coordinates, so the very center of the galaxy is right here. So, of course, the hottest spot of radiation you find is in the very center where the dark matter density is the highest. Okay. So there's also other. So there's also sort of a diffuse glow of annihilation that comes from sort of all the particles in the halo, right? It's much lower intensity because the density is relatively low out there. There's also sort of regions of high density, which I talked about yesterday, galactic satellites. Okay, so sort of dark matter dominated satellites of the Milky Way within about 100 or so kiloparsecs. And that's a region, if you had a pointed telescope or if you had a tensor telescope that could look in that region, you could actually potentially detect a signal from there. Okay. So the pluses and minuses of all these regions. Okay, so for example, for the galactic center, the signal is expected to be booming, but you know there's lots of astrophysical processes going on in the galactic center that produces gamma rays, right? So nature in that region knows a lot of ways to produce gamma rays, okay, outside of just dark matter. Okay. If you want to look at satellites, which is what I'm going to focus on in the next few slides here, right? So they're relatively farther away than the galactic center, which is about 8 kiloparsecs, right? Maybe a factor of a few farther away. But they have good source identification, right? So they're experimentally easy to pick out, right? If you want to point your telescope. So that makes it good. So there's lower background in that regime because they tend to be high above the galactic plane, sort of away from all the junk you see in the plane. So those are positive. The negative, of course, being they're farther away and their flux tend to be much lower. Okay. You can also look at clusters of galaxies much farther away, sort of diffuse glow from extragalactic background light. So I should note that all these signals are being searched for by various telescopes around the world. Okay. Just in this talk, I'm going to focus on a couple of the most promising that we've made progress on in the past, in the past year or so. Okay, so with what are we going to detect the signal? Well, I'm primarily going to focus on the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. So Fermi, if you're not familiar, was launched June of 2008. Okay, so it's a NASA mission. There's scheduled 5 years for Fermi, potentially funded up to 10 years. So if you haven't been paying attention, Fermi's really operating much better than anyone could have ever anticipated prior to it being launched. Okay, so if you look at a general sky map of what the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope sees, so Fermi, it detects photons from the energy range of about 100 MeV to up to about 30 GeV. So the brightest source of the sky, well, actually, the brightest source of the sky is actually the Earth. Okay, but the second brightest is actually the galactic plane, okay, which is what you see here. Okay, so here's all emission from the galactic plane, which largely comes from high-energy extragalactic cosmic rays colliding with particles in the interstellar medium and creating photons, yeah. The albedo, right, just cosmic rays crashing into the upper atmosphere. Yeah, albedo.
Yeah, they call it the albedo. Okay. So Fermi, like, it orbits the Earth, right? But so there's actually a fraction amount of time, right? There's a fraction of the time it has. I mean, there's obscures its view of the background sky. So that's why it has to take about a few hours to map out the whole sky. Yeah, there's also actually expected to be emission from the moon, stuff like this, and other planets in principle.
Why would the
so just cosmic ray processes?
Yeah.
Okay, so. So outside the Earth and potentially the planets, right, the largest, the biggest signal you see in this telescope is the galactic disk. There's other point sources that have been detected by Fermi. So in total, so the Fermi satellite in 1 year, right, they published a catalog of about 1,500 point sources. Okay, roughly 2/3 of these are identified in other wavelengths. So if you go to say an infrared telescope, something like this, you can find that source there as well. Maybe 10% of these are time variable, okay? So really, there's a bunch of really great astrophysics that this satellite has done here that's sort of encompassed in this map here. But for the purposes of my talk, this is just going to be foreground that we need to understand if we're going to extract a particular signal from dark matter. Okay, so what particular signal are we going to extract here? So like I said, I'm actually going to talk about what we've made progress on in the past year or so. And that's detecting emission from the most dark matter-dominated satellites, galaxies that we know that orbit the Milky Way. Okay, so here's a rough schematic picture of what we're trying to do here. So here's a distribution I showed yesterday of extremely faint dark matter-dominated satellites of our galaxy. Here's the Fermi map again. So basically, schematically, what we want to try to do here is detect, say, an object, say one of these objects, right? Emission from this object, you know. Embedded in this background map here. So that's really the challenge of what we're dealing with. Okay, so just a very brief slide on why, you know, an additional reason why looking at these satellites is really interesting. Well, we actually know how much dark matter they have. Okay,
So relative to other sort of astrophysical systems, right, these satellites, they're relatively easy to model, right? Because basically what you just see is you see old dead stars that are orbiting in a dark matter potential, okay? And stars really contribute little to the total gravitational potential. So basically it's just in some, right, it's in its simplest incarnation, it's just a physics 101 problem, right, where you're just calculating the mass distribution from an observed velocity dispersion of the system. So here's an example of a velocity dispersion of a particular satellite, which we looked at. And so really the way that this game is played here is, once again, you take the data, you find out how much dark matter the object has just by looking at its stellar kinematics, right? And you take that dark matter distribution that you find, and you can predict the flux from that particular object. So the way you predict the flux that you would see in a telescope is you just simply calculate the so-called astrophysical piece, which is the integral of the through the density squared of the object. Okay, it's a density squared because you're talking about annihilation of particles. And there's the spectrum of photons that you expect from your particular model. And so these are the spectra that I showed in the previous slides. So take your given particle physics model, right, with a given annihilation cross section and a mass, right, make predictions for the flux that you would see given how much dark matter you have. Okay, so another reason why these things are interesting, say relative to the galactic center, not only lower backgrounds, but this integral is actually much more difficult to calculate for the dark matter distribution in the galactic center. Okay, it's a well-known problem in this game. Okay, so that's sort of our motivation here. So let's actually, for a slide here, get our hands a little bit dirty with the data and look at how we model a given source. So this is a gamma ray spectrum towards a particular satellite, like I showed in the last figure. So like what these satellites, this particular satellite here is about 70 kiloparsecs or so from the Milky Way, okay, which is relatively close by on a cosmic scale. So what you see here is when you look at this a region of the sky with Fermi, you see the data points, you know, really beautiful data points shown by these black squares here. And sort of to model this region, what you need to know is you need to know what the extragalactic foregrounds are, right? The galactic foregrounds are, right, as well as any point sources that are nearby that you want to model out. Okay, so here's all the point sources that are in the regime of this object. So by point sources here, I mean those active galactic nuclei or blazars. Okay. So here's the extragalactic emission that you model. Here's a galactic emission that you model, right? And you add these together, right? And if you see if that's a good fit to your data, okay? Okay, so there's sort of standard routines to model these spectra that the collaboration has published in different regions of the sky. So that's where these results come from.
You examine the spectra, say, within 1 degree or so around a given satellite.
And what's the physical origin of the
these things?
The gamma rays? No, the upper curves.
Oh, the upper curves. So these are from diffuse emission in our galactic halo. So for example, cosmic rays coming in. So you know, to look at a satellite, you know, cosmic rays come in, hit the disk, and create gamma rays from collisions, and you have to model that region. Okay. So what you're looking at here at best, let's say if you have a spectrum that comes in like this, a dark matter spectrum that comes in like this, right? So what you're looking at is sort of you're looking for anomalous regions in the spectra that can't get well fit by the foregrounds. Okay. So this is a particular fit that we did. So we put in a spectrum, okay, of a particular model, okay, and what you find is you just solve for the amplitude of that spectrum. Okay. See how much dark matter actually is allowed in this particular fit. Okay. So there's no dark matter component here because by and large what we found is that this data is consistent with no contribution yet from dark matter. Okay, but in that way, by getting a limit on how much and how large the amplitude is, you can actually go translate that to an upper limit on the annihilation cross section of WIMPs. Okay, so that's really how the game is played here. Okay, so what do we really care about? So we really care about, right, you know, how strongly can the dark matter interact with itself relative to like how massive it is. Okay. Okay, so here's sort of the 100 GeV range, which is kind of the sort of classical golden mass for the particle from cosmology, right? And here's the annihilation cross section. And there's a so-called thermal relic scale, right? Where once again, if you go through and you plug in a particle which has a cross section of about 1 in these units, you know, you get, you know, about the right relic abundance of dark matter in the universe. Okay. So really what we want to do here is we want to get down to this scale. Okay. So once we get down to this scale, then we say, I think we've said something fundamental either way about what the dark matter is. So where are we right now with these satellites? This is roughly where we are. Okay. So each of these curves come from a different object with about 1 year of Fermi data. Okay. These are upper limits such that, right, if you have a model
that predicts an annihilation cross section and a mass up in this range, right? Then your model's ruled out. Okay. Yeah.
Models with a much much smaller annihilation cross section avoid creating too much dark matter.
These ones right here. Well, I mean, there turned out to be resonances actually, in when you actually do the detailed calculation of the abundances.
And but you can also have a few wave annihilation. Very large and turning. Nothing at all.
Nothing at all. Yeah. So right. The standard scenario is that these are so-called S-wave annihilators right now.
Why is it the standard scenario?
Well, because the P-wave dominates early, right? And the
right, but you may not have any S.
You may not, Maybe I was a little too compromised with standard,
It's really not too important what these dots are. There's a lot of argument about these dots, but really, you know, once you get sort of this red area, really the point is you're getting to something that's cosmologically really interesting. Okay. Good question. So this is after 1 year. Okay. So, you know, right, if you just say we're statistically limited, you could roughly scale this, right? I'll show some projections here in a minute. But it actually turns out, you know, we might not just be limited by statistics because the experimental, you know, we're cleaning, you know, different sets of photons are coming out. You know, we're getting photons at lower energy, photons at higher energy. So different sets of data is being released. So sort of, right, where we haven't seen photons yet, right, we're definitely not statistics limited, right, where we haven't really analyzed the regime of photons yet. So right now, we're only able to detect photons down to about 200 or so MeV. But in the next sort of incarnation of data, we'll be able to push that much lower, right? And you might be able to constrain WIMPs of lower mass. Okay. So you know, rejection techniques are being tested with the data. So it's not pure statistics. Yeah.
What about this Willman and Segway?
So that's actually not on this figure yet. So I'll talk about that in a second.
It's lower or it's not?
It's about the same. So these were the way you might ask, like, why were these objects picked? Well, because like they're sort of the most known, tried and true tested objects that we know, you know, pretty conservatively have a decent amount of dark matter. Okay. So once again, I want to iterate. This is about 1 year of data. Okay. So how are these things improving in the future? Well, one way we're improving this is a preliminary figure from an analysis that hopefully will come out in the next few months. Stacking the dwarfs together. Okay, so I won't really go through the details because a lot of this is just a data interpretation issue, getting your likelihoods right. But if you ask, get an effective emission by stacking these objects together, right, you can get a better limit than what you can get just by looking at individual dwarfs alone. And so, for example, here's several curves of updated limits from the individual objects. And here's what we might expect for a stack limit. Okay, so this is roughly where we're shooting for and roughly where we think we can get. And really the point I want to get across here is look at about 100 GeV, right? Here's the thermal relic regime here in this solid figure. Where, you know, I think we can realistically say with this type of analysis, we can get to within a factor of few. Okay. So different ways to interpret this data, right? Adding different photons. I think we're actually converging on something that could be really interesting.
And if SkyMapper and LSST and all these things, you find more dwarfs, does that help?
Yeah, good question. I think that's my next slide. So here's an example of how you can improve this, right? So as I talked about yesterday, Sloan has surveyed about a fifth of the sky, and in the process detected, you know, new objects that are very close to us and that are just as dark matter dominated. So here's an example of this object, Segway 1, which Niyesh talked about. So really just the point I want to get across to you here is that this is the limits that we project in the same parameter space. So here's sort of the thermal relic regime again. Okay, so this band here represents our astrophysical uncertainty in the dark matter distribution in this object. Okay, so really, if you want to be really conservative about it, you can say anything above here is ruled out. Okay, so if you look at the mean of this, at the mean of these limits, it's roughly similar to what we got from the well-known objects. Okay, I should also add here that bluish curve. This is for the Fermi limits. There's also so-called Eritrenkov telescopes, right, which are able to measure gamma ray emission at higher energies than Fermi. Okay, so they're able to go up to about a TeV in the photons that they can measure. So that they're sensitive to WIMPs of much higher mass. Okay, so once again here you have a regime that is dictated by the astrophysical uncertainty in this object. So anything kind of above this regime is ruled out by these Eritrenkov telescopes.
Okay, so these are two complementary experiments that can cover the large part of this parameter space in the future. Okay, so this is just a standard spectrum that annihilates to two BB bar quarks. Okay, so you know, you could also put different spectra in there and it would change the results a little bit. Okay, so that was a sort of projected limit. So let's go into a little bit more detail in this slide about these Eritrenkov telescopes. So where are they at right now? So Veritas is an Eritrenkov telescope that's done an analysis of several of these objects and published in the last year. So same parameter space here, thermorelic regime once again right around here. So you can see the sensitivity is not as good as Fermi, right? There's about a couple order of magnitude gap between the theoretical and the experimental regime. But once again, there are much higher energies that they can go to. Okay. So these are based upon maybe tens of hours of observations per object, whereas you know once again, Fermi scans the whole sky every 3 hours. Okay, so these are pointed instruments, right? So you know it's right because if you talk to someone on the committee that tries to do observing time for these telescopes, right? They look at this gap, right, and they say, okay, I'm not really going to give you too much more than 10 hours, right? If you were like right here, then okay, maybe. Okay, so what can we do? What can we expect to do in the future? So see, these are some rough limits, what we project in this plane in the next several years. This is a figure made by a couple colleagues at Slack involved in future Eritrenkov missions. So here's roughly where we are for Veritas and ACTs. This is the regime that I showed before, same parameter space in terms of mass. So there's the talked about Eritrenkov telescopic array, which, you know, the specs are changing sort of routinely, but, you know, given sort of mild, rough estimates of what we expect for these specs, we should really be closing in at high mass in terms of the close to the thermorelic regime. So here's some optimistic predictions for what Fermi could do in something like 10 years. Okay, so we know at low masses, at low Wnt masses, Fermi is actually expected to do really, really well and cover the thermorelic cross-section regime, right, if it hasn't really done so already. Okay, so really this is just kind of to get across like how exciting this game is and how well we're going to do and we expect to do in the next several years with these types of measurements. Okay, and I haven't even talked about other sort of programs in dark matter that Fermi is in, measuring emission from the galactic center, diffuse emission from extragalactic sources and clusters, et cetera.
So
this is just a typical, the particle physics is just a typical BB bar spectrum.
No, but you're going to the energies where EB bars cannot be.
Oh, so this is MEV, right? So, right, so this is
so here it's about the last place where you can produce BB bar, and here you cannot, right?
Yeah, so let's see, if I convert this to GEV, this is so GEV is here, right? Yeah, so I mean, we're kind of crapping out here. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So this is just for the known dwarfs, or
this is just for a particular known dwarf? Yeah,
a particular known dwarf.
A particular known dwarf. And so this doesn't account for other ones that get detected in future surveys and characterized,
or for stacking.
So how much better can you do if you have a line?
Well, so the initial initial paper published by Fermi looking for lines just diffusively in the galaxy, which you're probably familiar with. So the upper limit on the cross section they placed for lines was about 10^-27.
Okay.
Which is good, of course, but the typical expected cross section in the lines is a couple orders of magnitude below that for standard mutually interplay models. Okay, so really roughly this is about the scale they're at for looking for lines. So that was from diffuse emission from the halo, but it's similar looking at one of these objects. Okay. So I think that's this should conclude the first part of my talk about indirect detection in the next 20 minutes or so. I'm going to talk about how to directly detect WIMPs, okay, and how this might be complementary to the IGO. Yeah.
To get, you know, from a luminosity to these kind of plots, you've got to assume something about the dark matter density profile inside these.
Yeah, planets. Yeah.
I assume you're going from the stellar motion.
Yeah, we're going from the stellar motion.
These systems are disruptive and you now control.
Yeah, them. So there's a big sort of tale that I actually didn't bother the audience here with about how to actually do that. So it turns out, right, you go, let me just go back to the figure real quick. So yeah, basically what you do is you just take this data, okay, of these stellar kinematics, you effectively do a likelihood analysis, right? You model a profile in some way, NFW type profile or some variance of it, and you get sort of the errors on the parameters of the model,
right? And then you sort of feed that through this particular calculation. And of course, you have to assume, you know, Fermi or whatever has the field of view that it has. And so you calculate the so-called, right, this is in the, right, the J factor, right? This is, that all comes into calculating this mess here. Yeah, so it is, right, you do have to model the profile in some way, but you know, the argument here is that given this data and given how relatively simple these systems are, you know, we have a much better handle on how much dark matter is there than, say, what's in our center of our galaxy. Oh, good question. Another sort of detail. So it's not actually theoretically expected that there's much substructure in these particular galaxies, because that would be like, you know, substructure of the substructure, right? Because this is actually substructure of the Milky Way itself. According to some recent simulations and modeling that have been done, that can't be probably more than a factor of, you know, it's got to be probably less than 2, conservatively. Okay, so let me try to go forward here in the next few minutes to talk about direct detection. So I talked about annihilation of WIMPs. So effectively, you can turn the diagram around, right, and search for WIMPs scattering off a nucleus, right, in underground detectors, and looking for a signal that comes from the energy deposited from the recoil of this nucleus, right. So this is 100 GeV WIMP or so, and you're hitting a nucleus at rest. Non-relativistic kinematics dictate that you get a recoil at about tens of keV or so. Okay, so very low energy. So just a brief background of this field. So initially, maybe, I don't know, about 30 years or so ago now, it was gone through when these detectors were first proposed, these types of sort of low recoil energy detectors were first proposed. What types of signals would you see in these things? Well, initially it was thought that, okay, they could detect solar neutrinos. Okay, I'll get back to that story towards the very end of the talk here. But in this paper by Goodman and Witten, they kind of went through and said, okay, how can we detect sort of anomalous dark matter particles in the halo? So really what they broke this down to is sort of standard, what sort of, you know, interactions would you be sensitive to? What kind of properties, would the dark matter have that you could be sensitive to? Okay, if you sort of break this down really basically, you could have spin-independent interactions, which roughly give you a cross-section that scales like the mass number of the nucleus. Okay, because you get the so-called coherence effect with the nucleus at these energies. You could have a spin-dependent cross-section, right, where the WIMP sort of picks off an unpaired nucleus in the nucleon, and you could interact via that mechanism. Or also, they talked about strong interactions, where roughly the low energy limit of these strong interactions is just the geometric cross-section. Okay, so once we're going to be primarily focused on these guys here, but to sort of set the scale about where these guys sit in the larger aspect of dark matter interactions. So basically, if you just say, okay, here's a cross-section of a particle with a nucleon, right, and you scan all the possible amounts of parameter space that you can see, you know, you get a big logarithmic scale that looks like this, and here's another logarithmic scale in mass, right? So here's the so-called strongly interacting regimes, right? There's constraints on these types of particles from satellites and cosmic ray detectors, okay? Also, these particles actually wouldn't get underground to your deep underground detectors because they'd interact with material in the Earth. So there's the weakly interacting regime, which we're sensitive to with these underground detectors. Okay, so roughly the part of the parameter space that WIMP searches are operating now is this lower left corner here, sort of in the grand regime of masses and cross sections you can think of. Okay, so that's the regime we're going to focus on. And so here's an example of some modern dark matter limits. So different various experiments are shown here in different curves that have different sensitivities depending upon what exactly the type of nucleus that they're employing. So this is really the very tip of this parameter space here. This is just theoretical predictions for supersymmetric models, and this, you know, this would continue all the way down here if you continue its axis. So roughly the scale we are here per nucleon, you know, roughly maybe 10 to the minus 43, 10 to the minus 44 centimeters squared. Okay. So really what I just want to get across in the next few slides here is that these limits are getting very interesting, and they're getting much better. And so we're going to kind of need to understand how to theoretically interpret these results. And that's what I'm going to go into in the next few minutes. Okay, so there's a couple different ways to interpret these, right? There's a particle physics component, and then there's an astrophysics component. Okay, and both are important if we're going to try to understand what the dark matter is actually made of. So let's sort of take a step back here and look at what the theory you know, we expect, you know, how much dark matter is in our coffee cup and how is it distributed. Okay, so the theory of cold dark matter roughly gives you a two-power law density profile that looks something like this. So this is the famous Navarro-Franken-White profile, where if you look at, so roughly here's where we are in the galactic halo. Well, actually, this is density divided by scale radius, so we're probably somewhere around here. Okay. So there's an R to the minus 1 regime, right, in the central region of the galaxy, and an R to the minus 3 regime in the outer regions of the galaxy. So it's really not understood why this is true even in pure dark matter simulations, but the idea here is that, you know, a relatively shallow profile like this, a less than isothermal profile in the center, right, tells us, you know, ultimately something fundamental about the connection between dark matter halos and large-scale structure of the universe. Because pretty much any simulation you run, you know, you get a power law profile that looks like this in n-body simulations. Okay, so we don't theoretically understand this yet, but this is just going to be taken as an input of our model. Okay, so what else do we need to know about galactic halos where they're not smooth? Okay, the density is not smoothly distributed throughout the halo. Okay, so let me just, this is a bit of an arcane plot here, but let me just say in words what we mean by this figure here. So basically the idea is, like, if we have a local environment of dark matter, right, you know, we know the halo is not smooth, right, we could be living anomalously in an overdense region or an underdense region. Okay, so what's the probability that we live in an overdense or underdense region? Well, if you, according to the best modeling, the best theoretical modeling and the best simulations that have been done, well, actually, it turns out the signal that we see in these experiments is not going to be dominated by any substructure, right, or any sort of, you know, astrophysical clumping in the halo. It's probably going to be dominated by the smooth component of the dark matter halo. So even though halos are clumpy, right, we pretty much believe that this signal, right, if we model the smooth component accurately, we can get a pretty good estimate of what we expect here from an astrophysical perspective. Okay. So that's one component. So the one component is, you know, how much dark matter is in your coffee cup, how clumpy is it. The other component is how fast it's moving. Okay, because really to knock one of these nucleons in these detectors, right, we're going to be sensitive to really fast moving dark matter particles. Okay, so we need to know the distribution of velocities of dark matter particles in the halo. Yeah.
Saying you don't care about this response, this like high density.
Yeah, so I'm saying, so basically what this tells you, this is the probability that you measure a value of a local density relative to the canonical model value.
Density is a smooth ensemble scale, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. I assume this is done for the simulations, which have a certain resolution.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you can sort of, right, so you can analytically argue why this must be true as well. So there's a power law tail here that this is the idea this component comes from, this component here. But the idea is that this, you know, the probability of getting this regime is 10 to the minus 4 or less.
I mean, this is with the resolution of the simulation.
This is with the resolution, this is assuming the same, the physics doesn't dramatically change as we...
But why wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, right. If you get to, like, a free streaming scale for the dark matter, it might...
What are the different curves?
Oh, the different curves, I think, are just different realizations. They're different. So AQ1 here just means different simulation. Different resolution of the simulation.
So why are they so different?
What's that?
Why are the curves?
Oh, because the idea is here, like, in the lower resolution models, which is these green ones here, you can't resolve...
The resolution.
You can't resolve the clumpiness that you can.
And you're saying that tail actually is a small contribution?
The tail is a small contribution. Yeah, that's the model. Yeah, so basically the idea is, like, you know, relative to the central value.
But it's obvious that this hasn't converged because different resolution view is different tails, right?
So I think according to the best theoretical modeling, right, I think this is. Okay, so really what I'm going to be focusing on from this point is modeling the smooth component of the halo, and I'm going to argue that there's actually some interesting physics here to consider. Okay, so we need to know not only how much dark matter exists around us, but what its velocity distribution is. So if you look at one of these same numerical simulations and you calculate what's the velocity distribution in what would be our solar neighborhood, you find a curve like this. So these colored figures, these colored lines tell you roughly sort of the uncertainty in the velocity distribution just by going from different regions around the halo at the distance where the sun would be. What you get are some interesting features here, some bumps and wiggles, which show up at very high resolution in these simulations, which are thought to be sort of part of the dynamical assembly of the halo. Really, it's not physically understood why those are there yet. But for direct dark matter detection, what we're going to be most sensitive to is, like I said, the tail here, sort of the highest moving particles in the distribution. So we really need to understand what's going on out here.
And I should also mention that this dash curve is a Maxwell-Boltzmann fit to this distribution. Okay, so this Maxwell-Boltzmann models, this is typically used to model what the signal is in these direct dark matter detection experiments. So really what I want to address is, you know, relative to what we predict in cosmological simulations, how good of a model is this standard Maxwell-Boltzmann model? Okay, so you'll notice right away here that there's an overprediction out in the tail, and I'm going to try to motivate physically why this is true in the next couple slides. Okay, so really, so there's some theory that goes into this. I'll just try to point out the main results here in the interest of time. So we have our NFW profile over here, right? And you can sort of, you can make some simple assumptions of isotropy and spherical symmetry of the halo, which we know aren't ultimately right, but it sort of gives us a good physical intuition for what's going on. If you make those assumptions and you calculate a velocity distribution from this NFW type profile, right, you do sort of the best you can to model the potential component for the baryons. You peel the sort of simple physics going back to Poisson's equation here, you can actually calculate a velocity distribution from this NFW profile. Okay. And if you sort of look at sort of the limit of the very tail of this distribution here, okay, so this is the velocity distribution, this is just the tail that we really care about for direct detection. So how does this relate to the parameters of the NFW profile? Well, you find a sort of really simple relation between the tail of this distribution and the outer slope of this NFW distribution. Okay, so these, so if you sort of just, you know, do an expansion, you'll find to many orders that that the tail of this distribution is roughly characterized by what the outer slope of the NFW profile looks like, NFW-like profile looks like. Okay, so what does this tell you physically? This tells you physically that sort of any particle that you detect in a direct dark matter detection experiment, it's going to spend most of its life out in the outer regions of the galactic halo. Okay. So basically, you're really, really sensitive to these particles that are very, very near the escape velocity. Okay, so anything you detect is just going to be kind of visiting the solar neighborhood, right, very briefly. Okay, because those are the fastest moving particles that are very close to the escape velocity. Okay, so this is really just sort of a physical way to see that this is going on. Okay, so if you sort of apply this and compare this prediction, sort of this NFW-based cosmological prediction to sort of standard Maxwellian models, what you find is, as I showed in that previous figure, that sort of standard Maxwellian models really, might say drastically overpredict what's going on in the tail of this distribution. Okay, so here's a standard Maxwellian curve. So here's the tail end of those of the velocity distribution for that halo I showed a couple slides ago. Here's the full distribution here. So you can kind of see, just even though we're making assumptions of spherical symmetry and isotropy, right, which these halos clearly are not at some level, right, you know, we can actually get a pretty good handle in describing what's going on here. Okay. I should also mention, too, that we're just really including dark matter here and just basic models for the gravitational potential of the disk. But you know, our speculation is, which we really haven't verified yet, but it's plausible that, you know, B and Z's particles spend much of their time in the far reaches of the galactic halo. They're actually not really influenced by what's going on in terms of the baryonic distribution of stars towards the center of the galaxy. So I think that hypothesis, I mean, needs to be tested in sort of more detailed numerical simulations. Okay. So really just what I want to get across here at the end of the day is this is it's really interesting to sort of model different components of our galactic halo and sort of, you know, how these affect what's going on in direct dark matter detection experiments. Because if we want to know what the WIMP mass is and what its cross-section is, right, we really need to understand these issues as good as possible. So just briefly here, let's talk about what's its effect on measured recoil rates. Let's say and what I say here is I want to compare a sort of standard Maxwellian model relative to a model with a steeper slope, such as you'd expect in an NFW variation type of model. And really the point I want to get across here is that for heavier target nuclei, this actually is a much more dramatic effect. Okay, and really this is physically really easy to imagine because, right, for the heavier nuclei, you're much more sensitive to what's going on in the very tail of the distribution. You've got to whack it really hard in order to get a signal. Okay, so really any experiment that's very, very sensitive to what's going on in the tail is really sensitive to these astrophysical effects here. So here's a curve for xenon, germanium, and as you can see, for a lighter target like sodium, there's relatively minimal effect. Okay, so this is another reason why we might need several direct dark matter detection experiments in order to fully disentangle what we see in terms of interpreting a signal. Okay, so the last couple minutes here, I want to talk a little bit about dark matter astrophysics. I won't really spend too much time, but I just want to say, you know, if you go through and you model the galactic halo, you know, how precise can you determine the WIMP mass in the cross section given say you detect, you know, tens or hundreds of events? Well, this banana here just roughly shows you how well you can actually reconstruct that WIMP mass if your WIMP mass is about 50 GeV. So this is, you know, if you look at the look at the width of this solid curse here. This tells you how well you can do, say, with a one-ton experiment, right, which is talked about in the next several years, with hundreds or so events in your detector. Okay, so similarly, you can do complementary studies between different targets. I won't really go into detail here, but you can just show here that, you know, for a xenon type detector, you get a red curve if your WIMP mass is 200 GeV, and then if you combine different experiments such as xenon germanium and argon, you know, you can reduce the error bars. Okay, so there's a lot that goes into these figures, but this is generally the point is, you know, eventually, like, if we detect a signal, we're going to want to know what the WIMP mass is, and we're going to need to want to include what's going on with the astrophysics, and this is the method to do that. Okay, so I've got a couple minutes left here, so I'm going to spend the last couple minutes talking about a subject I'm relatively interested in. So, right, we don't really know that WIMPs exist yet, okay? And we're trying to detect them. It'd be great if we detected them. One thing we do know that exists are neutrinos, okay? So initially, when these direct detection experiments were proposed, they were proposed as a method to detect solar neutrinos. Okay, back when a couple decades ago when this solar neutrino signal was attempted to be characterized. Okay, so it turns out you can get the exact same signal in these detectors from a neutrino as you can get from a WIMP. Okay, just because you get this coherence effects in the cross section. Okay, so non-relativistic scattering. Right, so you can, the way to look at this is neutrinos of energies of MeV or so, right? The wavelength of that neutrino is much larger than the radius of the nucleus, right? So it doesn't resolve the whole nucleus, right? So you get this coherent enhancement. An interesting aspect of this signal, right? We've been able to characterize various types of neutrino interactions, high and low energies, but this actually coherent cross section with solar neutrinos on nuclei has actually not yet been detected, even though it's a fundamental prediction of the standard model, actually going back to the 1970s and even beyond. Hasn't been detected in the lab because of the experiment. Yeah, there was
talk about doing this with a spallation neutron source in
Oak Ridge, but as far as I know, that went kaput. Yeah.
Well, you detected that higher energies and some inelastic things, and so you go to lower energies, your rate is smaller, so you need a big machine.
Okay, so it actually turns out that this is either a background or signal, depending upon, I guess, your perspective, right? So the question is, right, if this is a background, where does this background come into direct dark matter detection searches, and where do these neutrinos come from? Okay, so of course they come from the sun, but we're sitting next to a nearby star, which produces a massive flux of 1 to 10 MeV neutrinos. There's also neutrinos at these scales that come from the atmosphere, okay? Also from diffuse supernovas. So all the supernovae that are collapsed in the universe make a diffuse background of neutrinos at this scale. Okay, so this is roughly what we expect for the spectrum. So we know we're at tens of keV. This is the recoil energy that we care about for direct detection signals right in this regime here. You can see there's kind of a booming flux from solar neutrinos that has a kinematic endpoint, depending roughly on your detector. So for xenon here, this kinematic endpoint is about 4 keV. Okay, so if you just set your threshold right here, right, at about 4 keV, you'll be roughly independent of the signal. Right, if experimentalists want to try to detect the signal, right, then thresholds can be lowered to lower energies. Okay, so this would actually be sort of a fundamental background to these processes if you can go that low. Really, over all recoil energies, though, sort of at much lower rate, a couple orders of magnitude below, you get contribution from atmospheric neutrinos and diffuse supernova neutrinos. Okay, so the question is, where does this collide with the direct dark matter detection figures? So here's roughly where we are, you know, between 10 to the minus 43, 10 to the minus 44 centimeter squared per nucleon. Really, these direct detection experiments actually have to stop because of these neutrino backgrounds. About 5 or so orders of magnitude less than where we currently are. And it should be noted that there's actually, 10-ish ton experiments that have been talked about and proposed, right, that actually could get down to the scale and could detect this signal, right, or could make it an irreducible background, depending upon your perspective. Okay, so that's actually the end of the talk here. So, yeah?
Like how big an experiment do you need to get there?
Oh, a 20 ton, I think, exactly. Well, depending roughly on what type of
thing. 20 ton of what?
Xenon.
Xenon.
Yeah, so.
And about how big is the diagram?
So xenon right now we're at hundreds of kilograms, which fractions of a ton.
Right.
So 0.1 times a ton.
Just with this corner of the market on the...
Sure.
possibly. So I should also note, right, this is the background, but once again, it's also a guaranteed signal, right? And there's also, you know, in principle, there's particle physics process you could test with a signal that you're unable to test with standard neutrino testing experiments.
But I thought the, maybe not the coherence scattering of the nucleus would be the most interesting, but just the regular PP neutrino.
Yeah, you could also argue, right, so yeah, PP neutrinos really, I mean, they've kind of, haven't been conclusively characterized and detected yet and understood in much detail. Yeah, exactly. So PP neutrinos are at much lower energy. So I should say, yeah, let me point back here to this figure. Well, yeah, so this is just comes from the high energy tail of the solar neutrino spectrum, the so-called boron 8 neutrinos, right? So if you plotted this for PP neutrinos, you might get like something that starts up here and goes down like that, right? And so I should also mention that CDMS, they just did a recent low energy analysis of their data, went down to about a keV or so. So if they got maybe a factor of 10 times more exposure, right, they'd be the first experiment that would be sensitive to actually this curve, right? And there's some interest on that collaboration to go forward with that analysis. So actually, let me just conclude by just reviewing what the outlook is for this field in the next several years. So I hope I've convinced you that the search for WIMP dark matter is progressing very rapidly. Indirect detection experiments, in particular, Fermi is doing a great job. The Fermi dwarf limits, my opinion, are getting very interesting. And if you haven't really been paying attention to these, this literature in the past year or so, I encourage you to start paying attention to it. So we have a stacking analysis forthcoming, which you know, can only improve things by definition, provided nothing actually went wrong previously. All right, so new objects are being discovered, as we talked about, right? So we've only mapped out about a fifth of the Milky Way in terms of its satellite population to the depths that we need. Okay, so it's very possible lurking in these other surveys, we're going to discover more dark matter dominated objects that we can use to set limits or detect dark matter. Okay, so direct detection constraints are becoming much more stringent, as I talked about. Interpretations are going to be really important. So there's like kind of a nexus, both people sort of in the particle physics world and sort of the astrophysics type world are really, really, you know, coming together in the past year or so and working on these interpretations and how we can best, you know, reduce uncertainties to extract WIMP masses. And I did talk about a guaranteed signal of neutrinos, which I think is really interesting and something to keep your eye on in the future. So with that, I'll stop here.
Can I ask my question? Because I need to go after this. So for the dwarfs, you look at the backgrounds and you subtract those off, and that limits ultimately your sensitivity.
Right.
And you kind of know what those backgrounds are now because you've got an all-sky map from Fermi.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of signal to figure out what the backgrounds look like.
Yeah.
Is it still, if you go back and ask, are the dwarfs still the best thing to look at? Do you know the answer to that?
So
if you, for instance, stacked on the 1,000 nearest bright galaxies, you would presumably get a background from those too.
Yeah, right.
So would you win or lose?
It's somewhat of a religious question, right? Depending upon what you work on. But I think if you look at clusters, right there, which I think is what you're referring to, there's a couple, like the Magellanic Cloud or something.
M81 or something like that. You know, how does it compare?
So we did actually
M31. We did actually look at, there was actually a signal detected from M31 after 2 years of Fermi data, but that signal is consistent with what one would expect for a cosmic ray population M31. I mean, you can turn that around and use that as a limit on the WIMP signal, right? And you know, who knows, there might be some fraction of a WIMP signal sitting in there, right? But it's sort of you know, in general, Fermi's only detected maybe 5-ish external galaxies. And by galaxies, I mean, you know, star-forming galaxies, not like AGN or Blazar or something like this. You know, you could look at those and you could model those objects. You know, on the one hand, you don't have as good of an understanding of how much dark matter exists there, so it's hard to, you know, draw these curves with any confidence, really, whatsoever. And, you know, theoretically, your flux tends to be lower.
Echo for 1,000 objects at the Fermi resolution? I'm not sure.
I mean, so I should say there is actually an effort now going on to stack clusters of galaxies. Okay, so there's different systematics with those because those tend to be a little bit more extended than the
see,
thing.
Clusters, I wouldn't be happy. But if you just stack, you know, things in RC3 or something,
yeah.
You know, you're averaging over quite a large area
yeah.
within those systems. So rotation curves and things like that tell you, once you stack 1,000 of them, they actually tell you pressure.
Sure. I mean, the question is, do you not care about the gas distribution in these galaxies and whatever other sources?
No, you don't, I mean...
But I mean, so in principle, there will be some signal in those types of galaxies, right? If we're not talking about completely old and dead things. The data exists, so it's you. Right? You're so inclined, go for it.
The stacking has been done for clusters, and there's no detection.
There's no detection, so there's no current detection of any, you know, emission from clusters at this stage. Right. I mean, that it was prior to launch. It was, you know, give or take, they may detect something at this stage. I would say there's probably a pretty good chance, given the model, to detect something in 10 years. Not even if not dark matter, there's some master physics.
Yeah, I know. As of November, they haven't heard.
As of November, yeah, there wasn't any. I think there was a little bit of disappointment because I thought in year one, some people thought there'd be something seen, but yeah.
Questions?
I guess the Galactic Center works the same way. It sets an upper limit if you assume everything coming from.
Yeah, you could do that, but then you know what? How much does that mean, right? I mean, you get a roughly weaker upper limit. Then, right, if you want to be very, very conservative, right, you make the distribution of dark matter as flat as you can, you know, with, I mean, the problem with the galactic center is, right, you see just, you know, a very small slice of, you know, Fermi sees a very small slice towards the center, right, and, you know, if you change the profile by a small amount, you know, you get wildly different predictions for what you expect. Whereas for these objects here, right, you know, they're basically, you can model the point sources within your field of view. Right, so all the dark matter is sitting here, so it's you know, base is much more independent of what you assume for the profile.
Any other questions? Okay, well, Louis will be around for the rest of the day, and if you'd like to talk to him personally,
I'll be, I think, 4:59.
Great, thanks for coming.
Yeah.